Welcome to the Album Nerds Podcast with your hosts, Don and Dude.
Love is like a bomb, baby. Come and get it on. It's the Album Nerds Podcast. Isn't that beautiful? I'm Dude. I got Don with me.
Good morning, Album Nerds.
That was 87? Oh my God. I'm old.
Good morning, Vietnam!
Robin Williams. So, yes, this is indeed the Album Nerds Podcast. We love albums, the album format. We love the 80s.
Certainly do.
We've been taking quite a journey through that decade. We've got a great show for you today. We're traveling to 1987, and the beautiful, wonderful Wheel of Musical Discovery has dictated that we talk about albums from 87 that are country or rock. So that's what we have done. Of course, then Don will be asking us a deep question. Then we'll have some shout outs to some other albums and album related items we're digging. New stuff for the most part. Then we'll spin that Wheel of Musical Discovery to learn what we'll be talking about in 1988. Until then, it's all about
1987. That's what I'm talking about.
BMX bikes get across suburban driveways as other kids peg each other with koosh balls.
My mind went other places when you said peg each other. Continue.
America discovers the new Fox network while RoboCop blasts onto movie screens. Three men take care of a baby and nobody puts baby in a corner. Huh? A new generation of Star Trek warps onto TV, promising strange new worlds for prime time.
Yeah, and a boring captain that doesn't get in fights every time.
Today, one of us spins a country standout, and the other cranks a rock record that defined 1987. So grab a slice from the Pizza Hut buffet and blow into your Nintendo cartridge. This is 1987.
So many good albums in 1987. Mm-hmm. So many of which we have talked about on the show previously, mm-hmm. which, you know, helps keep it challenging for our picks this time around. But some of the other considerations in the rock realm, Guns N' Roses, Appetite for Destruction, which I believe we talked about last summer.
Yep.
U2, The Joshua Tree, which we've talked about at least once. Mm-hmm. One of my very favorites of the time, In Excess, Kick.
Good one.
I would have loved to have talked about that one again.
Yeah. Even Whitesnake we talked about.
Yeah, another great one.
The one group I hope we get to eventually is Dinosaur Jr. And I think yep. they're kind of a forgotten sort of...
Yeah, they don't get enough credit.
Yeah, yeah. Sonic Youth had an album, Sister. The Final Smiths album, Strange Ways Here We Come, came in 87. The debut, Faith No More, Introduce Yourself. Nice. Yeah. And then country, well... Probably my favorite one we did before is that trio album from Dolly right. Parton, Linda Ronstadt, and Emmylou Harris. George Strait. Poor George Strait. We've come close to doing him a few times. But Oceanfront Property, I think, was one of his biggest records.
Yep.
Tanya Tucker.
I think it's Tanya.
Tanya. Tanya Tucker.
I like it better that way.
Love Me Like You Used To.
We'll talk about that later, Don. All right. The picks are in. The house is full. It's time to have mercy on 1987.
Was that an Uncle Jesse?
Yes, it was.
Have mercy.
You choose me?
My country pick from 1987 comes from Randy Travis and his album Always and Forever. It's his second studio album. He was born in 1959 in Marshville, North Carolina, kind of a traditional country singer and songwriter. He was a troubled youth mentor.
What?
Yes.
No.
He doesn't look like it, but yeah, no. he's trouble. Wow. I think even at this time and, you know, I think throughout his life he had some.
Really?
Yeah. I think he did some hard living.
Jeez. Yeah. That was not what he was selling.
I think he kind of took the torch from like George Jones.
Oh, no. Yeah, that's wise.
Right. Well, anyway, let's start the album off. Here's Too Gone, Too Long.
It's been so long since you walked out my door. Now you're just an old song nobody sings anymore. I got a
burn.
So, Too Gone, Too Long was written by Gene Pistilli, kind of a, you know, as you hear there, a mid-tempo, kind of straight country feel, bit of a western swing flavor. Lyrically, you know, it's talking to an ex who wants back in, you know, built around the phrase, too gone, too long. It's themes about moving on emotionally after a breakup and closing the door for good. So, kind of nice.
So, like a no going back.
Yep. Day late, dollar short.
That could have been another song on this album. So, the album kicks off with this organic instrumentation in a time when music was getting quite full of electronic drum sounds and synths and things of that nature. So I think that's part of the appeal here. It's just, it's simple. It's clear what the song is about. It's relatable. It's pleasant. You like the guy and it doesn't change throughout the album. I mean, that's what he's selling right here is what you get throughout the whole process.
Yeah. Very similar, you know, to the approach the Judds took on that album we did a few years ago. Well, we did it weeks ago, but the was it 85 or 84?
In the context of I Love the 80s.
Yeah. But yeah, you know, I mean, other than some guitar, I mean, you've got some steel guitar in there, I think, as well, which I think really, you know, sounds great on this album.
Well, what adds to it is there's no anger, right? It's a resolute confrontation, and it's like there's emotional withdrawal at this point, and there's this dignity and composure, and that's what like Randy Travis it was to me, was a controlled man who's discussing these topics without letting it break him.
Yeah. And even his vocal approach, the kind of, I mean, he stays sort of in that baritone range. You know, he doesn't push it too much.
When he goes up, though, it just sounds, I'll keep saying it, but like front porch in a small town, you know?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Lemonade sitting next to him while he strums his guitar.
Absolutely.
Country time lemonade.
All right. Well, let's try another cut. Here's Good Intentions.
I hear tell. To hell is paved with good intentions, but mama.
So, Good Intentions was written by Marvin Coe, Merle Haggard, and Randy Travis.
Yeah, it sounds like it could have been a outlaw country time period track. I think that's why it works here. It's smoothed down a little bit.
Yeah.
Like this guy doesn't have a beard, you know?
Yeah, that's true.
No cowboy hat.
Right. So, you know, lyrically, I think he wants to, you know, be good for his mama or whatever, but I think he, you know, keeps screwing up. I think that actually in the story, I think he gets arrested and doesn't end up seeing his mom before she dies, which is quite sad, but typical of country storytelling.
I grew up with this one. My parents, my dad in particular, played this tape constantly, and I hated it because I hated country music, but I really secretly didn't. I mean, I have good memories of listening to it looking back, so clearly it did have an impact on me, a positive one. But what's funny, though, in this neo-traditional revival of country music where it's that front porch swing kind of, you know, back to basics, and he's not a cowboy with a cowboy hat like on the album covers. He's got, on this album cover, he's got this big gaudy gold bracelet on, which reminds me of that episode of Friends when Joey gives Chandler the bracelet.
Check it out, we're bracelet buddies.
But so it's kind of this like modern, but you know, traditional. And I think it was intentional because the Judds weren't running around wearing cowboy hats and, you know.
I mean, their hair was kind of big, but that was the
80s. Yeah, everybody's hair was big in the 80s. So, yeah, this song is just a perfect mix of life lessons, but also relatable and clean.
Yeah, I think what drew me to it is just the lyric, I heard tell. I think I'm going to start incorporating that into my, into my lingo. All right. Well, was there a cut you wanted to highlight?
Of course, there's the big one, Forever and Ever, Amen.
I love you forever, forever and ever, amen.
This one was one that I enjoyed and pretended I didn't when I was a youngster. Like, you just see it. You just see the whole thing. You see the couple. I've seen the video, too, which has a wedding in it, but it's just so real and heartfelt feeling, and it really captures love and caring and and these like homespun folksy ways of describing the kind of love it is, you know, because old men will sit and talk about the weather forever, and women, old women will talk about old men forever. And I mean, I hate to use the word cute, but yeah, it is
cute.
It's freaking adorable.
Yeah. Even the approach, you know, again, it still has kind of that stripped down vibe, but it does have some electric guitar in there, adding some light fills. Again, there's some pedal steel in there swelling, which I like the use of the pedal steel rather than like strings.
Yeah, I agree. It keeps it grounded in that traditional twangy, but not twangy. You know, the music is twangier than the vocal delivery.
Yeah. The vocal approach is great for storytelling because it's almost conversational. Like it's like barely singing, you know?
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we come to the closing cut of the album tonight. We're going to tear down the walls.
And tonight we're going to tear down the walls. We're going to laugh and drink and dance and have a ball.
Are you sure this isn't about a home improvement project? They should use this for the Home Depot commercials, you know?
Yeah. I do think this was inspired by Pink Floyd.
Of course.
So Tonight We're Going to Tear Down the Walls was written by Jim Sales and Randy Travis. So Randy Travis gets songwriting credit on three or four of the tracks on the album. And I think moving forward, he starts to get more.
Yeah. This was his second album. And you know, then once you got the big hits, then you can start flexing some muscle. Yeah. This song, I remember it vividly because it meant the end of the album, which meant please don't flip the tape and play it again. Let me play something. But it's a great song. It's a great closer, and it is the most fun, probably. Yeah.
Definitely the most up-tempo track, I think, on the record. And it's, you know, it's lyrically built around the idea of breaking down emotional distance in a relationship.
I thought it was about having a party.
Well, I think it's kind of both.
Oh, well.
Yeah, I don't know.
Mr. Deep Questions over here.
But yeah, well, I think, yeah, there's tension in a relationship. And then, you know, tonight we're just going to let it all hang out. We're going to.
So it's a sex party?
It could be. All right. Okay. Well, let's rewind and reflect on Always and Forever. I'll begin with my clickbait headline. Travis delivers slow baritone tales to your kitchen radio. I don't know why, you know, I just kind of picture sort of an old timey kitchen with a radio. Yeah. And I think this music would, you know, just sound perfect coming out of it.
Sunlight pouring in the window with those like kitchen curtains people used to have that were like short.
Right. And like you said, maybe a pitcher of lemonade on the counter.
A formica table with the metal accents. Yeah.
But this is, you know, part of that kind of neo-traditional, you know, movement of country music in the 1980s.
Well, it's tapping into some of the same stuff that Heartland Rock was, just, you know, without the rock.
Yeah. I think now the three country albums we did in this I Love the 80s series, we started with Alabama, which was hinting at that neo-traditional thing, but then the Judds, you know, pushed a little further. And I think, you know, Randy Travis is even more basic than the Judds were. Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, so my clickbait headline to describe the album, Always and Forever feels like sunset, sweet tea, and old men talking about the weather. It's entirely cohesive and maintains a consistent emotional tone. That front porch, small town USA feeling just, you know, it shines through it. And I picture some of the same stuff as like when I'm listening to a Mellencamp record. But every song reinforces the themes of love, heartbreak, longing without overproduction. And it's really enjoyable, I think, for casual listeners and country purists. So really nice. Yeah. Fun listening to this after all these years.
I guess Garth Brooks kind of pushes it more in that sort of rock direction.
Yeah, the more spectacle and swinging around on ropes. Whatever.
That's all I picture. All right. Well, killer to filler. I mean, you know, all the tracks are, you know, charming in their own way. I think another, you know, standout cut is the I Told You So, which is sort of a heartbreak ballad. I think that one was written by Travis himself. Are there other ones you like?
What Do You Do About Me? I really dug a little upbeat steel guitar, but it's like, you know, he's going to haunt his ex's life no matter how far she runs.
Yeah. It kind of sounded like she was, like he was the other side of the tracks for her. And he, you know.
Right. The truth is lying next to you.
Yeah. Another clever one.
Or gentle, but it's like proof of love with the partner sleeping by his side. You know, that's the truth. If they're together, then that's where the truth is.
Yeah, there's some clever lyrical thing in there where he's saying, the people saying I'm cheating are lying. The truth is lying next to you. You know, that's that's cool.
You didn't throw any lion eyes in there?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I hate to identify anything as being like filler. I mean, it's all... I think it all works.
Yeah, I mean, in these discussions of I Love the 80s, we're not really stumbling upon too many albums that have weak spots, yeah. like glaring weak spots. There's some songs I like less than others, but nothing that just screamed like shouldn't be here.
Yeah, I agree with that. And the production, well, the album was produced by Kyle, I think it's Lehning, L-E-H-N-I-N-G. He was known for, you know, country production in the late 80s and early 90s, leaning on kind of clear vocals and unfussy mm-hmm. band arrangements. And that's exactly what this is.
Well, there's so much in the 80s, we think of that specifically, that drum reverb. None of that here.
Yeah.
And that's why it feels so timeless. This could be recorded by, you know, any of our current sort of stripped down.
Yeah. Casey, you know,
Charlie Crockett's. Or, oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but there's a ton of these young artists out there that are in this same realm of country music, and I love it because it is forever
yeah.
and ever. Amen.
I think, and this is a couple years later, but I think they did a better job in capturing that intimate sort of space than like the Judds did. I know that's what they were going for on that record. And I feel like on this, it's probably more like what a record would sound today. And I think they've sort of perfected that sort of intimate yeah. production.
Agreed.
Replay value?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's timeless, like I just said, not much filler, emotionally honest. So yeah, it's over before you even begun. Sometimes it felt like, oh my God, it's over already. I'll listen to it again. It's just pleasant and relatable, and you can dip your mind in as deep as you want or just enjoy his pleasant voice and the nice sounding traditional instrumentation.
Yeah, I've got a little rental RV trip coming up, and I think this will be a perfect album for the morning, you know, sipping coffee, sitting outside in the campground, you know.
Pretend to strum a guitar.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just bring one with no strings. So
yeah. I wonder if anybody would notice. All right. Well, legacy.
I mean, the legacy is like we were just talking, a lot of the modern country artists that take this similar approach. I think this made it okay. This change was huge because it brought country music into more, you know, outside of the country and into the suburbs and, you know, like families like mine that started getting into country music because of guys like Randy Travis. Mm-hmm. So that's legacy for me.
Yeah. And this cemented him as being, you know, one of the faces of country music. And I think there mm-hmm. was a transition maybe away from the Dolly Partons and into the Randy Travises and Garth Brooks and
George yeah, Strait.
Yep. Well, Always and Forever plays like a quiet reset button for 80s country, narrowing the focus to a voice, a small band, and a handful of plain spoken songs that feel like they could live forever and ever. Amen. Check it out and let us know what you think.
Excuse me. I'd like to ask you a few questions.
It's time again for Deep Questions by Don. We continue our I Love the 80s versions of Deep Questions, where we look at significant musical moments or developments from that year. So what are some significant musical moments or developments of 1987?
So for me, there were two moments that were important for two of the predominant genres of the time, one that was both were growing. Public Enemy's Yo Bum Rush the Show, their debut album, came out. That started to reshape hip-hop beyond what we talked about with Run DMC. Mm-hmm. More social, more gritty, more real, more angry. And then we had Guns N' Roses on the metal side of things with what became that vision of the ugly part of LA, more real and raw and less romanticized, I guess. So different from what was happening before that, you know, the Sunset Strip stuff. And this was getting into like the gutter part of it.
Yeah.
And so these two big genres really started to get a little more real mm-hmm. and a little less fantasy.
Yeah.
I think that's important to what was to come in the late 80s and into the early 90s in particular.
Absolutely.
What about you, Donnie?
Yeah, well, kind of along the same lines, I was kind of thinking about the evolution of, I guess, first kind of college radio as like a genre of music, and it,
yep.
And then for a while it was being called like modern rock and then alternative. And so that's really more than bubbling under the surface, starting to find its way onto like top 40 radio. So you start to hear REM, 10,000 Maniacs, the Cure, and you start to have radio stations like K-Rock in Los Angeles, WDRE in New York sort of move to an actual alternative format. You had to be in a big city to get a station like that.
Right.
You know, several years later, where we start to get them in our, you know, medium-sized cities. But yeah, you know, it's just, we're about 4 years away from Lollapalooza.
Yep. Yeah. So I think that the things we talked about are very much connected in terms of people looking for the real in their music.
Mm, true. All right. Well, what other significant musical moments or developments happened in 1987? Let us know on our social media, like Instagram and Facebook, at Album Nerds.
So, it is my turn.
It is.
Def Leppard, their 1987 mega hit, Hysteria, produced by Robert John Moot Lang.
Jeez, yes.
as they said it. So, Def Leppard, English hard rock band from Sheffield, formed 1977 out of a local school group, Atomic Mass. By this point, the classic era lineup was Joe Elliott on vocals, Steve Clark and Phil Collin on guitars, Rick Savage on bass, and Rick Allen on drums. And they had an early success with melodic heavy rock in their first three studio albums, and they were part of that new wave of British heavy metal, along with like Iron Maiden and stuff. They just took a different path as they grew. Mm-hmm. So this album was preceded by Pyromania, which I think is my favorite Def Leppard album from 1984. But this was the follow-up, and it took them a long time to get to Hysteria. So why don't we check out a little bit of the opening track, Women. So I really didn't spend a lot of time just thinking about this and listening to it over and over again and trying to glean the depth, the meaning of what this might be about. Don, you have any insights?
Well, it's you know, pretty ambiguous. No, well, I do think they're, it's almost like a God created women, or almost like it's a sci-fi experiment or something. And
right,
you know,
yeah, I mean, there's something. Thematically, this is very Kiss-like to me, but with a more advanced sonic palette.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, it's clearly about women.
And they like them.
They want the world to know. The tone is fun, flirtatious, a little tongue-in-cheek, you hope, right? But that's kind of typical of pop metal themes of the time. But the layered vocals and the layered guitars and the, like, pristinely created soundscapes of these songs. It starts here with the with the first track.
Yeah, this was the first single in the United States, and
yeah.
I guess they did it deliberately because, I mean, they had been gone for so long, and I think they wanted to sort of reestablish their like hard rock bona fides or something. Because
right.
This is definitely not one of the catchier songs on the album.
But yeah, I mean, I think it sets the tone for the album and, you know, what a lot of it may be about. So speaking of romantic songs and not being crude at all, let's listen to a little bit of Pour Some Sugar on Me. What became the anthem of brass poles everywhere. Pour Some Sugar on Me. The definitive glam metal, if you want to call it that, anthem. I don't really think they're glam metal. I think it's more of a pop metal thing. They're wearing t-shirts and jeans, you know?
True.
Which I appreciate about them. But it was their breakthrough single, propelled the album to heights unseen. An album that cost a ton of money to make because of the years it took to produce, their drummer losing his arm and having to learn to play with his feet and his remaining arm, and problems with production, and Mutt Lang wasn't available, and they were working with Jim Steinman, and finally Mutt Lange came back around, and they spent a lot on this thing. And if it weren't for this song, I don't think they would have recouped the millions they spent on the production of it.
What's funny is Steinman was trying to bring them into like a more raw direction.
Yeah.
Which doesn't seem typical, because I don't think of like, I think of big theatrical stuff with Steinman, you know?
Well, they had spent two albums having Mutt Lange harangue them into do it again. It has to be perfect, and making it all sound perfect. And Steinman was like, yeah, nice take. And they're like, we haven't even tuned our instruments yet. What are you talking about? But the lyrics of this one use playful, sugary metaphors to express desire and attraction. I always thought, now I don't know about you, Don, but this always made me think of Sugar Sugar by the Archies. But I always thought, when it first came out, I thought about that song.
Yeah.
So what were your thoughts on this one, Don?
I mean, this song was just so huge back in the day. And, you know, as a kid, I remember being like, oh, Def Leppard's back. And, you know, this, I mean, all of a sudden they were just huge. And this album was like the biggest album of that year.
Yeah.
But the song is just so catchy. I mean, it's got the great Dan and but just, hey! Hey, they're so good at that. That kind of became like the Def Leppard signature.
Well, that had also been adopted by bands like Bon Jovi.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
The gang choruses, but no one does it like Def Leppard does. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's rare that you are only hearing one voice at a time on this record.
I don't know how they do it live, because there's so much vocal harmony stuff going on that's like beyond some human capability. But apparently live, they are able to pull off, they all sing, drums, everybody. So
yeah, it's the lyrics are just so like overt, you know, and just not subtle at all. And there was a little more subtlety, I think, on Pyromania, a little more mystery to them.
Well, things loosened up by 87 a little bit with what you could get away with in the Entendre. But this is probably the most straightforward rock song on this for me, and definitely my favorite. Don, what did Def Leppard do for you? What did they teach you?
Well, they taught me that love bites.
I love that lyric. Smart.
It is smart. Yeah, one of the smarter moments on the record. But yeah, because love bites. You know, so it sucks, but it bites because it hurts.
Yeah.
And also, I mean, I remember having a puppy. You know, when a puppy would kind of nibble on you, you would call it a love bite. Yeah.
But I just think it's that sort of more darker or violent image, not violent, but you know what I mean, where everything had to be in this pop metal world in particular, you had to make some references to pain or suffering, and they do it in such an effective way here, but also making it that love is worth it.
Yeah.
It brings you to your knees,
but it's worth it. Powerful force.
Yeah.
It's a great power ballad, I think, from the era. Yeah. And then just that guitar in the chorus, it's very well done.
This one hit number one on the Billboard charts, I believe. Love doesn't bite that much.
I like the bass in the chorus, or I'm sorry, in the verses, the dum dum.
That is cool too. Yeah.
The Def Leppard bass is kind of interesting. It's always got like a little bit of distortion to it. Almost sounds electronic.
Yeah, it's always a little nasty.
Yeah, yep, raunchy.
There you go, perfect. Why don't we jump into the closing track on the album, Love and Affection. In some ways, I think this is the best ballad. It's not as catchy as Love Bites.
Yeah.
It doesn't have a cool, like, Love and Affection isn't as fun as Love Bites in terms of imagery, but
right.
I think it's really well written.
This one really reminds me of Bryan Adams. I could totally see him doing the song.
It's just a husky voice.
It could be. And Joe Elliott sounds great on this song. You know, I really like when he brings his voice up to that higher register. I like it better than when he's down here and
Yeah, I like it down there.
Do you?
When Joe's bringing it, yes. The song, like it focuses on vulnerability, longing, emotional dependence, and it's less flamboyant, I guess. And yeah. Is this the only one with synths on it? I feel like it's the only place I really hear like keyboardy stuff.
Huh. That had not occurred to me, but you might be right.
Yeah, it's a good closer. I mean, it's a long journey to get here. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of songs in between, and none of them are small. They're all huge, so.
It's a softer ending. You know, it begins with the hard-edged women, and then.
Love and affection.
Yeah.
All right, well, why don't we take a little time to rewind and reflect on Hysteria. My overall vibe can be summed up in a clickbait headline. Def Leppard out-Jovied Jovi by making pop metal feel massive, precise, and keeping the hooks, but adding teeth.
Mm.
Def Leppard's Hysteria here really does stand out as a testament to the massively ambitious and cohesive version of the stadium rock that they kind of helped us reestablish in 83 and 4. And when they were off recording for 3 years, bands like Bon Jovi came in and kind of took the torch, and I feel like they took it back here.
Yeah, or Mutt Lang did, maybe.
yeah. But they retained hard rock credibility for the most part here. They weren't pinups the way that Bon Jovi became. I mean, they were to some degree, but this was still considered, and at least in my school and stuff, as hard rock. It wasn't considered pop music, you know?
It's funny because that like Slippery When Wet was very Mutt Lang sounding, you know, and it's almost like this album is a response to that.
We're going to do it right.
All right. Well, I'll give you my clickbait headline. Too much sugar drowns out the strong notes in this stadium rock blend.
So I'm making a coffee.
Yes, reference. Exactly. Just, I mean, they are a talented group. You know, I mean, I think Joe Elliott is a great metal singer. The two guitars are great. But, you know, it is a lot. It's almost like, I feel like every song has three hooks, three choruses or, you know, two pre-choruses and then a chorus.
And there's so much going on. Like, there's so many sounds happening all the time in every song. It's there. You don't get a break. There's no acoustic number on here where they break it down no more than words. It's like you're in the stadium for every track.
Yeah. And, you know, it works. And I appreciate, you know, the album. But I guess just from a personal listening standpoint, it's just a bit much for me.
I warmed up to it. I hadn't dug into it deep for a long, long time. And with every listen, it became less laborious. Mm-hmm. So what were some, if we're talking about killer to filler with so many tracks, what were some standouts for you or some weak points?
My favorite track is Hysteria. I just think that's a beautiful song. Probably like my favorite kind of power ballad of that era.
So you like that sound?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So here's your Pink Floyd reference.
It all makes sense now.
Goodbye, Blue Sky from the Wall.
Yeah.
I mean, they're not exact, but
it's a similar.
Yeah. And maybe that's why this appeals to you.
Probably. It does have a sadder, melancholy vibe, and you don't get much of that on this album.
But then they pick it up, which is why I like that track so much as well.
Yeah.
It's a little bit of both.
Yep. Animal, I've always liked.
Yep.
Rocket.
Yep.
You know, they're all good.
Well, Rocket is one of those. You got to have a song about your influences. So they talk about David Bowie and Queen. And it kind of legitimizes too. See, this is where we come from. Yeah. You know,
all six songs from side one of the cassette were singles.
Yeah.
And I think at the time I probably would stop the cassette maybe after side one. But now listening to it, I grew to appreciate some of the cuts on side two. I like Gods of War a lot.
I love Gods of War. Yeah. And in Rocket at the beginning, they have some back masking stuff, and it's some line, it's from Gods of War being backwards. Don't Shoot Shotgun. I love that one.
Mm-hmm.
It's a metaphor. It's not really about guns. Run Riot.
Yeah.
They're on that second side. I think it's great. Did you have any that you could have just done without? Excitable is the only one where I'm like,
That's true. Yeah, that one's a little cringy. Although it gives you sort of a high energy response to Hysteria. Actually, in between, it's bookended by Hysteria and Love and Affection.
So, I appreciate the energy, but excitable. Yeah. It just feels like maybe a more dynamic word than excitable.
Could have cut that song and got the album under an hour, I think.
All right. So, production-wise, Mutt Lange's obsessive layering defines the album. Boom. That's all I'm going to say.
Yeah. Now, I'm not sure if you mentioned it yet, but I think the intention was to make every song a single or be worthy of being a single. And
yeah, the idea was to have the thriller of hard rock.
Yeah.
To take that template and say, they all got to be bangers.
But yeah, I wonder what it could have been had they let it breathe a little bit or
stuck with Steinman.
Yeah, I don't know, giving it more of an Appetite for Destruction sort of vibe. I don't know. We'll never know.
Nope, I don't think we need to. Yeah. Replayable? Are you coming back to this one?
Yeah, I just like you, I think Pyromania is my favorite.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'll come back to this. And I mean, there's just so many bangers on this album.
You can do this on your road trip.
Sure. Yeah, that's right.
Pour some sugar on me while you're trying to push the last couple miles to your next destination.
Sure.
Need that energy. All right. So the legacy, it bridged hard rock, pop, metal, and influenced a generation of arena and glam rock bands on their own terms. This is their own sound.
Yeah. I think it worked in two ways. So one, it continues to make hard rock more of a dominant mainstream sound. But on the other hand, I think this is some of what grunge reacts against a couple of years later. So it works in both ways.
I think grunge accidentally reacted against this. I think it was inevitable anyway. People do move on.
Sure.
But we haven't. Here we are talking about Hysteria and loving it. All right. Polished to perfection, stacked with arena-sized hooks, and packed with some of the most durable singles of the decade, Hysteria captures everything big, bold, and unapologetic about rock in 1987. Check it out.
Can you dig it? Can you dig it? Can you dig it?
So on your way back from the Catskills.
Oh, sorry. God, that's a deep, dirty dancing reference, yes, man.
You're welcome. Did you have time to dig anything else?
Yes, I did. As a matter of fact, U2, Irish rock band formed in Dublin in 1976, driven by Bono's impassioned vocals, The Edge's chiming guitar, and a legacy of socially conscious songwriting that has gone on for many decades in the post-punk era. They came out with an unexpected EP called Days of Ash. Six tracks released on Ash Wednesday.
Mm.
So Catholic, yeah. Irish Catholic, very clever. Five new songs and a poem with music included on it. And it's our first original music, original songs really released since 2017. Why don't we dig into a little bit of American Obituary? So this EP confronts urgent global issues by honoring lives cut short in real world events, reflecting on defiance, grief, and resilience. And they have an album coming out this year where this is completely unrelated, apparently. This was just made based on current events that are just happening in the last few months. So, that's cool. With the technology as it is, I think more bands should do that stuff.
Yeah. Well, and a band like U2, I think they're guilty often of leaving things in the oven for too long. And, so I like the idea of them just saying, hey, we got to record something right now. Let's do it.
I like that too. More like the early days when they're coming out with albums every year or two. Speaking of the early days, it's 1987 here in our I Love the 80s journey. And of course, U2, the Joshua Tree was one of the biggest of the year. So in my vinyl collection, I do have a copy of it. We talked about it a couple of years ago on the show, but again, U2, I'll include now Adam Clayton on bass and Larry Mullen Jr. on drums, get everyone in there. But the Joshua Tree was their fifth studio album, landmark record combining soaring rock, blues, and Americana influences. We listened to a little bit of a political track from this one, Bullet the Blue Sky. Yeah, they're at the best when they're reacting to the moment. So yeah, I mean, I've loved having that one on vinyl, and it just is such a part of my youth and childhood, and also part of shaping the sounds of the music I came to love later on.
Yeah, I love the sort of blending the sort of new wave post-punk sound with kind of more Americana and blues influences.
Yeah. All right, Don, what you digging there, buddy?
Well, a band from Manchester and kind of that Britpop era, The Charlatans.
What up to the UK?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm not sure. Maybe the other Charlatans went away because I think it was a deal where they were Charlatans UK because there must have been an American Charlatans.
Gotcha.
But my understanding is the current album does not have the UK label. But anyway, you know, they were, you know, they didn't break in America like, you know, Oasis did, but they were sort of in that Madchester scene, they used to call it. So they have a new album. It's their 14th, the first studio release in 8 years, collaborating with Stephen Street and Dev Hynes. The album's called We Are Love, and this is the title track. Yeah, this actually came out last October, and I remember looking at it and maybe listening to it once when, you know, we were trying to come up with our year-end lists, but I didn't really spend a lot of time with it, and I have recently, and I'm really enjoying it.
Cool.
Right. In theaters, there's a new Elvis documentary done by Baz Luhrmann, who, you know, just did the recent Elvis.
Yeah, I didn't see that. I just, when you say that name, I just think of that Lady Marmalade movie or whatever it was and how much I wanted to throw my TV out the window when I was trying to watch it.
Yeah, well, I haven't seen it yet, but I hope to see it soon. So it's a documentary. They have all this footage of Elvis in concert, you know, from like the 60s and 70s. And I think I think it focuses the most on his Las Vegas residency.
The karate moves.
Yeah.
Yes.
I know. I remember watching a documentary called Elvis on Tour before, and it's, even though it's so corny and cringy, it's captivating as well. He's such a great performer. But so there is a soundtrack that corresponds with this movie that you can find. Here's a little bit of Bridge Over Troubled Water.
He added quite a bit of spice to the Simon and Garfunkel version.
He really just wanted to be a gospel singer, I think.
Yeah.
That documentary that I talked about, Elvis on Tour, there's so much footage of him like after the concert, just hanging around a piano with the other singers in the band and just singing gospel all night. So I think that came out in his live performances a lot. But anyway, I'm looking forward to seeing that. I think on like big IMAX screens and stuff. So it's meant to be an immersive experience.
There you go.
So what are you digging? Let us know. Join us on the socials, Facebook, Instagram, Threads, and Blue Sky at Album Nerds.
It will be a discovery of extraordinary value.
Well, here it is. It's the time on the show when I'm reminded of the words of Jimmy Malone, played by Sean Connery in 1987's The Untouchables. They pull a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. Wow. That's the Chicago way.
That's pretty good.
Thanks.
Now find the cure to the plague of the 20th century.
With that in mind, let's bring out the wheel of musical discovery to see what kind of albums we'll be discovering in 1988.
Next time, we continue our I Love the 80s series with 1988. Smooth grooves and crushing riffs collide as we dive into R&B and metal, spotlighting two albums that showcase the flash, fire, and fearless contrast of the late 80s.
R&B and... No, thank you.
Can't do it. Rhythm and blues and heavy metal.
Love it. All right. Well, there was definitely some R&B and heavy metal in 1988.
Yeah, there was a lot of that.
All right. Well, what's your favorite records from 1988 and 1987? What else are you listening to? Email us at podcast@albumnerds.com or follow us on Instagram and other social media at Album Nerds. And you can visit albumnerds.com to listen to all 327 episodes. Best way to support the show is to share it. Please subscribe, rate, and review on your favorite podcast app. On your favorite podcast job.
There you go. Perfect. Thank you so much for joining us here on the podcast. We'll catch you next time in 1988.
All right. This television show debuted in 1987.
Name that tune.
You can count on me no matter what you do.
I know the song. Yeah. but I don't. I can't place it.
Wow, finally stumped you.
Yeah.
My Two Dads.
Oh, My Two Dads. Paul Reiser.
Yep. And the other guy, the handsome guy.
BJ from BJ and the
yes,
Bear.
Yes, that's
guy.
Right.
Well, you finally got me done. I think that one was just below my interest level at that age. All right, y'all. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time.